I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. For the rest of the show today, my colleague Nina Porzucchi is taking the lead with a story that takes us back to 1941. Hey, Nina.
So last week, Marco, you'll remember President Trump gave a speech in Poland.
Despite every effort to transform you, oppress you, or destroy you, you endured and overcame.
He delivered it in a very symbolic location in Warsaw.
It was in front of a monument to the Warsaw Uprising.
The Warsaw Uprising was a 63-day rebellion by the Polish underground against the Nazis during World War II. Thousands died. Much of Warsaw was completely destroyed. And that narrative of Poland as a nation of martyrs and heroes that you heard Trump highlighting in his speech, that's a narrative that the current Polish government has embraced. Mm. But while the Warsaw Uprising is an example of extreme heroism in an almost hopeless situation, the narrative of World War II in Poland isn't always so black and white. Mm. This past winter, I went with Polish producer Ursula Sławiec to the tiny village of Jawabna in northeastern Poland.
It's not a very big village.
No, no.
The church sits off Main Square. It's really, really cold.
Because the story of Jawabna is in many ways a murkier and more complicated depiction of occupied Poland.
Right. So that's the background. And listeners, a warning here. The story you're about to hear is also graphic at times, perhaps not suitable for younger listeners.
Right. So it all begins July 10th, 1941. A hot day. People remember the heat.
You know, it's July. It's very hot. Just they're extremely miserable. There are all kinds of little episodes that are documented.
Jan Gross is a historian at Princeton. That summer, he says, the region is on edge. Jawabna is not too terribly far from the modern borders of Belarus and Lithuania. In 1941, though, borders were an ever-changing fact of life in occupied Poland. The village had actually been under Stalin's brutal control for nearly 2 years, until this moment.
This is a moment in the summer of 1941 when Germany launches its attack against the Soviet Union.
German soldiers are roaming the countryside, unleashing violence across the region, especially against Jews. Gross says this is when
mass killings of Jews by Germans begin.
Tensions have been mounting for some time in the village. There are whispers that the Jews were communist collaborators backing the Soviets. On July 10th, these whispers become shouts.
And it starts by Jewish population being ordered to assemble on the town square.
Ordered by their neighbors to clean up the lawn, weeding.
Pulling out blades of grass from the ground. Surrounded by a growing crowd, beaten up. It's a lot of people. It's huge.
The Jewish men are then taken to a nearby square where they are told to knock down a statue of Lenin that had been erected during Soviet rule. Then the men are marched to a barn on the outskirts of town.
They carry this broken up statue to bury it within the barn. While they do it, they get killed.
The women and children left weeding in the main square are corralled en masse to the same barn.
The barn is locked. And some kerosene is poured on it, and it's set on fire.
The barn burns down to the ground.
That's what happens, you know. It's just a horrendous episode. And what's so unusual about it is that there is an effort to round up every Jew. In early July of 1941, the German mass killings of Jews that were already taking place were not of that kind yet.
Today, the town square is a large park covered in snowy ice. It's surrounded by shops and houses. The church sits on one end of the square. It was built in the late 30s. A date on the gate says 1937. I peek inside the church looking for Ursula.
Where did they go?
It's school break this week, and the village kids are assembled in the pews for church camp. A few girls pastor a young priest with a guitar about what to sing next. My producer Ursula speaks with the young popular priest. His name is Father Seraphine. Will he talk with us about the history of the town? Sure, he says, after Mass.
Flash,
If wars leave scars, then Poland has a deep red gash through its middle. Poland was the epicenter of World War II in Europe. For 6 years, the country was fought on both fronts, Stalin from the east and Germans from the west. 5 million Poles died during the war, 3 million of those Polish Jews. That's one-fifth of the population. No village was untouched. Fragments of the war are still everywhere today. In fact, just this past week, 2 unexploded World War II bombs were found, not too far from the village of Jawbabna. What does this do to a nation? Michal Bilewicz studies hate.
The scale of hate speech, the mechanisms of hate speech, why people use hate speech.
He's a professor of psychology at the Center for Research on Prejudice at the University of Warsaw. Growing up in Poland, he noticed what he calls the, quote, remnants of Poland's diversity. Abandoned Jewish cemeteries, memorials to massacres. And he wonders as well, how do all of these remnants affect the psyche of a nation, his nation?
The country that's affected so much by genocide, historical genocide, it becomes a very salient issue.
I met Bilewicz after he presented his most recent study at the Sejm, the Polish parliament. He was alarmed to discover in his study that over the past 2 years in Poland, there has been a marked uptick in anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, though there are very few Jews and even fewer Muslims.
In a country that has no immigration, it was absurd.
But as Bilewicz began examining his results, he found it might not be that absurd. That, in fact, the rise of hate in Poland correlated with the rise of something else, nationalism. In 2015, Poland elected a right-wing nationalist party called the Law and Justice Party. They campaigned on a platform of Poland first. Anti-immigrant rhetoric was rampant.
The leader of Law and Justice,
a man named Jarosław Kaczyński,
said that the refugees might be spreading parasites, illnesses. Their influx in Europe is actually a biological risk. This is something he openly expressed publicly, and then he presented himself and his party as the defender of the nation. And this is how you make voters.
It's like very scarily reminiscent of, I feel like, Nazis and Jews, like painting a picture of the disease.
Jews are rats. The Soviets are bringing rats together with them, and the rats were Jews. This imagery was used on Nazi posters in the occupied Europe, and particularly the occupied Poland. Why? Because this is a very effective way of reducing a chance of any helping behavior.
From 2014 until 2016, Bilewicz says hate speech online and on television in Poland grew at an alarming rate. This is the same time the Law and Justice Party is campaigning on their anti-immigrant platform. It's also the period when refugees are arriving to Europe in record numbers. And the thing is, the more hate speech we see, the more we stop seeing it, according to Bilewicz.
And this is very dangerous, because the more normal it gets, the more people are willing to offend other ethnic minorities themselves.
Since coming to power, the Law and Justice Party has refused to resettle refugees arriving in Europe. Mass ends. We look for Father Serafin. He is nowhere to be found. We walk to the rectory behind the church in search of the missing Father Serafin.
I mean, I wouldn't want to talk to either.
Another priest appears. Ursula inquires after the father. The priest at the door tells us Father Serafin is no longer available to speak with us. No one is available to speak with us.
We chickened out. Nothing to do with it.
For nearly 60 years in Jawbabna, there's a monument on the edge of town at the site of the barn. It commemorated the mass murder of the Jews at the hands of the Germans.
But this is untrue. They were killed by local people.
In 2000, Jan Gross published a slim book entitled Neighbors that shook Poland to its core. In the book, he attributes the events on that July day not to the Germans, but to Poles. Neighbors killing neighbors.
I didn't anticipate the kind of reaction which followed. The whole country was for several months totally immersed in this debate.
But should we try and talk to some people on the street?
In 2001, reporters swarmed the village of Jawbabna, and debates consumed Polish TV talk shows. The Institute of National Remembrance, a government agency that was formed to examine crimes of the past, began an investigation at the site of the barn. They exhumed bodies and found keys of the victims who had taken care to lock their homes that day. They found the statue of Lenin. They also found bullet casings. The Institute of National Remembrance published a many-volume report confirming the narrative that Poles may have been responsible for the deaths of their neighbors. And it wasn't just in Yevabna they found. Many villages in the region experienced similar events.
What kind of a question do you want to ask?
Because are you from here? What are your thoughts about the monuments?
We approach an older man on the street. His face is rough and red. He doesn't want to give us his name. He says he's from around. Ursula asks him if he's been to the Jewish monument.
I have you.
As he answers, the older man slowly shrinks away from us behind a car. Ursula interprets.
I've been once to the monument. I saw on TV when President Kwasniewski opened the Polish celebration, but they were talking that Poles kills all the Jews. And, well, I don't know myself. I can't know.
The older man is referring to July 10th, 2001, the 60th anniversary of the massacre.
A national ceremony was organized.
The whole country tuned into that ceremony on TV.
The president of Poland came there. A new monument was put up. The old one that attributed the murder to Germans was removed. The then president, Aleksander Kwaśniewski, spoke.
Jako prezydent Rzeczypospolitej Polskiej, przepraszam.
The president apologized, leaders from the Catholic clergy spoke, and the Israeli ambassador to Poland at the time, Shevek Weiss, also spoke that day. Weiss is a Polish Jew and a Holocaust survivor, and his speech was perhaps the most striking moment of the ceremony.
He said, and this was very memorable, that there were all kinds of barns in Poland, the one like in Jedwabnem, but also a barn in which he and his family were saved.
Yes, Weiss had been saved by a neighbor, hidden in a barn. In the years after Gross's book, the Polish government has worked hard to highlight that other kind of barn. The barn that Israeli Ambassador Shevek Weiss spoke about at the commemoration. The barn that saved him.
And I don't see anything bad in commemorating the righteous.
Again, psychology professor Michal Belevich.
But the problem is the way it is conveyed today. Because the way it is conveyed is, to me, a blasphemy to the memory of the righteous.
There's been pamphlets and books written, speeches given about the Poles who saved the Jews, called the Righteous of the Nation. Last year, the first museum even opened, dedicated to a family of Poles who saved Jews during the war. This year, on Holocaust Memorial Day, Polish Airlines, LOT, handed out a pamphlet to each passenger about the Righteous of the Nation.
This is creating an impression that everybody was righteous.
And it's just not true, he says. In fact, helping behavior is rare for us humans.
If someone fainted on the street, how many people will help that person? Only a few people. We know it from experimental studies in psychology that helping behavior is very rare. And so now I see this process in Poland of building the identity of a rescuing society, that the whole society was collectively rescuing Jews during the Nazi occupation. For me, it's a very personal issue because my family members, my grandfather and my grandmother, survived the war also with the help of heroic people during the Holocaust. And I really want these people to be commemorated properly. And also the memories of my grandparents were that not everybody, far not everybody, was rescuing Jews in Poland during the Nazi occupation. And for many Jews, including my grandmother, Poles posed greater risk to her survival than Germans, because the Germans could not recognize who's Jewish and who's not Jewish, and Poles could recognize. So these are personal memories. Sorry, I mean, it's not maybe a topic for, you know, intellectual debate about psychology of xenophobia in Poland, but these memories do not get represented in the new Polish historical memory.
Emphasizing the story that every Pole was righteous makes it easy to ignore and even deny what happened in Jedwabne, says Belevich. In fact, in an interview last summer, Poland's Minister of Education, Anna Zalewska, backtracked on the story. The tragic situation that took place in Jedwabne is controversial. Many historians, eminent professors, show completely different scenarios, she said. Zalewska is not alone. The current Polish president, Andrzej Duda, has been wishy-washy on the topic of the Holocaust. "We did not, as we are falsely accused by others, participate in the Holocaust," he said in a televised debate in 2015.
Okay, let's go to the cultural center.
Back in town, Ursula gets word that two women at the cultural center might be willing to talk with us about the history of the town. Inside, we meet Marzina and Katarzyna. Katarzyna is an elementary school teacher in town. She's got curly brown hair and round, sweet face. Her colleague, Marzina, is a bottle blonde with blue eyeshadow. They both run the arts programming for the kids at the center. They're about mid-30s. Neither cracks a smile. They offer us tea and biscuits.
Very nice. Have you gotten tired of Jedwabne always being in the news and being an example of some hard history?
Marzina answers as Ursula translates.
I was
not touched personally because at the time I was working hard till 5 p.m. and I have no bigger thoughts on it.
Katarzyna chimes in. She tells us that the local community felt totally isolated from the debate in 2001, that they had to accept what these outsiders were saying about their town and their ancestors, that there was no debate, that they didn't know what to believe, and they still don't.
Did she hear before, like, Jan Gross's book and before the sort of news broke out, did people talk about this? Was it actually...
A czy ten, to, te wydarzenia w, właśnie...
At this point, their shyness has completely worn off. Both women grow animated, angry even, talking over each other.
Marzina says that was shocking for me to hear all those news, because I remember having this little monument. It was always there, much smaller. It was said that Jews were killed by Germans here. And to commemorate them, we even went to the monument from time to time. Someone lighted a candle, and it was like always present in the map of town. Then when I heard about the whole story, it was just a total shock for me. I said to myself, like, I'm living here from like all my life, and I didn't hear about those events. How is it possible? And then Katarzyna explained that it is even more difficult for people to deal with this heritage, horrible heritage that they got, because they are a new generation that had nothing to do with those events. They just received a news one day that probably their families were involved, and they couldn't say. People who were present at the time, they were not there anymore, so they couldn't ask anyone. But they were just left with the feeling of guiltiness and nothing else.
They tell us that they do not believe the findings from the investigation done by the Institute of National Remembrance. Remember, they exhumed the bodies, found the keys, the bust of Lenin. Walking out of the cultural center, my producer Ursula is upset.
They have no idea. I'm sorry, but that was my impression. Like, the Institute of National Commemorance made the whole investigation. It was just closed. They have no clue about the history, and this is... Well, kind of understandable mechanism of defending oneself. They just inherited something that they can't really fight, so it must be really hard from like psychological point of view and really affecting the whole psyche of the community, right.
Especially, it's getting late, the sky is starting to turn pink. We decide it's time to find the Jewish monument.
I remember it was close to the woods.
There's a cemetery like straight ahead. Yeah.
There are many ways of dealing with the past. Accept it, grieve it, adapt it, ignore it, deflect it. 2 years after Gross's book came out and the new monument had been erected and the Polish president had come to apologize, psychologist Michał Balewicz and his colleague did a study on Polish attitudes toward Jedwabne.
We found that 1 year after these events were discovered, most people in Poland really negated these facts. They said either that these were Germans who did it, not Poles, or these people were killing because they were under pressure. They used all these exonerating explanations of the fact, not to say the truth, which was that Polish inhabitants of Jedwabne killed Jewish people in Jedwabne.
From a psychological point of view, denial makes sense, he says.
Poland very fast went to the language of guilt and shame, raising societal emotions about these problems. How now we should construct our identity, we should feel shame of that, we should feel guilty, and so on. So it was a little bit like imposing emotions of people before they really acknowledged the fact.
And while the country grappled with Jedwabne and this shame and denial, the Law and Justice Party was born.
Law and Justice, they started exactly in the same time.
The right-wing Nationalist Party, currently in power in Poland, was founded in 2001. And the party used the controversy in Jedwabne as one of their talking points.
They made these press conferences saying, Jan Tomasz Gross is offending the Polish nation. So this is exactly the start of the Law and Justice, is exactly the time of Jedwabne debate in Poland.
Oh, I'm going to fall on all of this ice.
Yeah.
Maybe it's right there, straight ahead with the flag.
Yeah.
So it's still sort of like in the middle of a bunch of fields.
The Jewish monument sits at the edge of a snowy field. The actual placard is a concrete slab with what looks like the charred door from the barn embedded into the slab. An Israeli flag stuck into the frozen ground flaps in the wind.
It looks like somebody is driving up to the monument. It's kind of interesting. I wonder who they are.
A black car pulls up. An older man and young woman exit the car.
Did you come here to visit the monument?
Lunch.
Where are you from?
Yeah, we came to visit the monument.
In the end, what did Jan Gross want from his book, from this little town, from Poland?
It's very simple. You have to acknowledge it. And once you acknowledge it, then you look around the world and it turns out that it happens everywhere. In Yugoslavia, for example, neighbors were killing neighbors. You just take a look at Rwanda and you will find that neighbors were killing neighbors. So, well, Poles, it turns out, are human beings like everybody else.
What brought you here? Where are you from?
I'm from Israel.
This is Adi and her father, Haggai.
Did you have family from Poland?
Yes. My father's family is not far away from here.
My mother and my father.
Yeah. Adi tells me that her grandparents, Haggai's parents, escaped the war and immigrated to Israel. And it was a Polish neighbor who saved their lives.
And that man, the Polish Rozinski,
Vladek
Rozhensky. He helped the family
escape.
He was a neighbor, and he helped the family. He helped to cross the bridge. It's a story, it's a big story.
This shows that people were living in coexistence. It's important to know that and still remember this story, that there was a coexistence in Poland, but nothing is perfect and stuff are complicated.
Haggai pulls his daughter Adi towards the monument. He wants to say Kaddish, the Jewish prayer for the dead. He lights a candle.
יתגדל ויתקדש שמי רבה.
אמן.
בעלמא דברא קריאתה וימליך מלכותה ויצמח פורקנה ויקיים משיחה. ויחרינו ויוכלים לחיי כל בית ישראל בעגלה וזמן קרוב ואמרו.
אמן.
ישמע רבה ובורך לעולם ולמאה.
The cycle of history. What a story. The world's Nina Porzuki there. An earlier version of her story aired on our podcast, Whose Century Is It? You can see pictures of what it's like today in the Polish village of Jedwabne over at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Hope you can be back with us tomorrow.